So in what way is historical poetics historical? Any subfield that defines itself as historical is particularly obliged to consider its own historicity. At some level, this means its own institutional formation, the divisions of intellectual labor, the ideologies of expertise, the dispositions and distributions of the materials of thought, as well as its history within other institutionalizing narratives. So one might place historical poetics as emerging out of an intellectual moment characterized by the new formalism and also by the new lyric studies. It's interesting that both the new formalism and the new lyric studies have recently, or in the last 15 years, been subject to discussions in the Proceedings for the Modern Language Association of America and also Modern Language Quarterly, that there's a link to these kind of institutional organs going on. The personnel are perhaps more evidently aligned with the new lyric studies than the new formalism, but there are several features of new formalism which are salient to historical poetics. There's a piece called What is New Formalism by Marjorie Levinson, which was in the PMLA in 2007, which kind of brings together a lot of these thinking, a lot of these accounts, I guess, which I'm going to be based on. So firstly, what Levinson calls active formalism, or activist formalism, which wishes, and I quote, to restore to today's reductive reinscription of historical reading its original focus on form. Secondly, the assertion that Levinson makes that this is a movement rather than a method, i.e. it is a specific disciplinary intervention motivated by the pragmatics of the institution rather than any transhistorical theorization. And thirdly, that this means there is no concerted work of redefining form, again that's Levinson, but rather a rededication to form. Rededication, again, is her word. However, what I find most interesting is that each pitches itself not just as new, but as the new, hence making some hegemonic claim towards contemporaneity. In the PMLA, the new lyric studies, Ray Torada, with welcome circumspection, starts off by saying, lyric has been new before. And Levinson also notes that many of the so-called new formalists are wary of that title. And as I said, it's very interesting that both should have been articulated within the sort of the house journal of literature studies, the PMLA, either under the theories and methodologies section or the changing profession. Both pitch themselves quite overtly as statements on the discipline and interventions into the current state of the discipline. It is this institutional orientation that is, to my mind, one of the main motors for its striking success in mobilizing a diverse array of thinkers into its matrix of questions in a short space of time. And obviously this conference is part of that disciplinary or institutional work, as Ben was just saying, insofar as it's now colonizing another part of English-speaking academe. I really shouldn't talk about colonization as an Englishman in this country, I'm sorry. However, the institutional history of historical poetics is not simply one of its institutional mobilization. What makes it interesting, in fact, is the way the subfield's formation is characterized by the interactions of two antithetical approaches to the institution, each firmly situated on one side of the Atlantic or the other. And it's, again, being so far away from the Atlantic that makes me happy to reflect on this. My foregoing account will be enough to demonstrate a slight lack of credulity on my part where the big institutional organs of American literary academia are concerned, which is not just an Englishman's distaste for Yankee professionalization and nostalgia for when literary scholarship was the preserve of the gentleman amateur, although I'm sure there is that somewhere in what I'm saying. But of course, this shows my affiliation with a very different institution. So in Cambridge, where I did my undergrad and my PhD, news from across the pond that Americans are now suddenly interested in the minutiae of how people composed, disseminated, and read verse, the discourses on, in, and of meter, say 150 years ago, is met with a blend of enthusiasm and proprietorial irritation, because in Cambridge that's kind of all literary scholarship has ever been, and we can't decide whether to be delighted that other people are finally coming around to our way of thinking, or threatened that they aren't actually coming around to our way of thinking at all, only asking what superficially look like similar questions. And I'm sure that Meredith knows exactly sort of how that proprietorial irritation plays itself out. And so one of the major features of the formation of historical poetics, as I think it stands in 2016, is its schism, as it were, the new lyric studies versus what was wrong with the old lyric anyway, or what I call the Rutgers Pen Nexus, which is named after two key meetings that happened in 2002, 2010, and sort of central to the formation of the Historical Poetics Group in the US, versus Cambridge, which has significant US outposts in Cornell and the University of Chicago. Or alternatively, take key publications, Meter Matters, which is a major publication of the American style, I guess, historical poetics, versus Thinking Verse, which is something that I edit and which is sort of seen as being a Cambridge-centred thing, even though it's never actually been centred in Cambridge. To see the institutional depth of this schism, one need only observe that this conference has, as its two foreign guests, Meredith and myself, one the former student of the figurehead of one nexus, Yopi Prinz, the other a former student of the figurehead of its opposition, Simon Jarvis. At this point, institutional history can verge on academic gossip, though a serious historical scholarship would hardly admit a neat separation between the rarefied intellectual work of poetics and its social life, or one might want to call it its material practice. But I would also like to suggest that this epithet of historical comes with its own history. In part, this is the increasing centrality of archival study, the development of genetic criticism, and so on, over the last 15 years. This raises questions about the institutions of archives themselves, how and where they are accessed by scholars, and how funded. To be historical, in this sense, is quite expensive, which may be one of the reasons why historical poetics has been so bound up in the institutions which confer influence and money. This isn't to say that there's any particular cupidity on the part of the historical poeticists, simply that there is a necessity through being institutionally recognised that this kind of research can happen. And in Britain now, humanities funding is increasingly contingent from a graduate level upwards on some element of archival work, the production and dissemination of data, a kind of new empiricism that kind of more or less coincides with the kind of much heralded death of theory that was happening about the time that I started a PhD on literary theory. But countervailing that, the possibilities for open access that are offered by digitization, which transforms what the archive can be and increasingly is. And as historical sources become increasingly available on databases and repositories, not least thanks to the dedication and application of people like Meredith and those of you who were at Meredith's workshop yesterday will have seen exactly sort of the extent of that dedication and application. As she said at the time, I did it so you don't have to, and I really feel very glad that I don't have to. It now means that a lexeme, say, can be tracked and a history of word usage told through word searches on Literature Online, say. But this does have the other effect that being historical can become, for an armchair prosodist like myself, the path of least resistance. But if these might flesh out a recent history of historical poetics, my question has a more theoretically expansive dimension, and this is what I'll largely focus on. Namely, what concepts of history or conceptions of history are at work in these different iterations of historical poetics? In what ways do they go about defining their object or method as historical? On the one hand, we can see historical poetics as a reaction against the desire to posit lyric as some trans-historical entity, or against a kind of Whiggish history of canonical white men creating seminal formal advances. After Milton, there was Dryden. After Dryden, there was Pope. After Pope, there was Wordsworth. After Wordsworth, there was Shelley, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, there must be something in Sappho or Catullus which allows their lyrics to be read outside of their time. And there must be some sense to the notion that Wordsworth found Milton more his contemporary than he did his walking companion Robert Southey, or a poet like Felicia Hemans, who was kind of the major selling poet, I guess, of their day. There are different kinds of historical correspondence merely than contemporaneity, or rather, contemporary is more than mere chronological coincidence, to which one can add a simple methodological difficulty, namely that the material practice of lived history is hardly reducible to the objects left behind. Literary historical scholarship is perhaps more of an excavation of a site on which is sedimented further layers of historical life since the period in question than the reconstruction of a discreetly defined moment from out of those objects, discourses, and so forth. Or, to say it another way, that when we decide to look at a set of objects, then are we taking the notion of a period, a historical period, as something for granted, rather than something itself, which is continually being sort of rethought and reworked retroactively, and so that the historical work that we are doing is actually a rewriting of sort of these historical categories which weren't necessarily contemporary categories. And so if the period is something that gives intelligibility to those times, then nevertheless that is something retroactive, that we're always stuck in our time to that degree. The dismissal of the transhistorical in Prinz actually strikes me as an assertion of historical scholarship as predominantly synchronic rather than diachronic, to go back to Saussure's terms. Which isn't to say that they do not trace historical processes, but that this happens through the reconstruction of, and I quote from Prinz in her recent What is Historical Poetics essay that came out earlier this year, the discursive arrangements that made poems possible from the inside out at a predefined moment in time. A moment which, crucially, is not our own and onto which our assumptions cannot be unproblematically transferred. For instance, in her contribution to the PMLA special issue in 2018, Historical Poetics, Disprosody and the Science of English Verse, Prinz argues that historical poetics is not concerned with the practical application of past conceptions of scansion. And this is the first quote in the handout that I hope you all have. She says, there are other more interesting questions. What response did Sidney Lanier, so she's talking about Sidney Lanier's Science of English Verse, which Meredith talked about yesterday. What response did Lanier get from his contemporaries, and can we read his ideas about sound in relation to 19th century theories of acoustics and music, or alongside other essays on prosody, like Edgar Allan Poe's Rationale of Verse, or Coventry Patmore's essay on English metrical law? How did these metrical debates contribute to Anglo-American literary culture, and what were the political and philosophical stakes of thinking about prosody? Although a New York Times review of the Science of English Verse complained that we are somewhat in danger of being scienced to death, what kinds of knowledge or ways of knowing are implicit in Lanier's claim to science? The first thing that strikes me about this quote is the rhetorical work being done by the word interesting, which is obviously designed to wind up any aesthete who thinks that the importance of excavating past models of scansion is precisely for its practical application, for a kind of an enlarged aesthetic response to these works. That then seems to be not what is interesting. But also, what worries me about this is the insistence, or the apparent insistence, that history is something that happened in the past. As I understand it, the onus on practical application is not treating these ways of hearing as transhistorical, let alone ahistorical. Rather, it becomes a means of addressing our historical moment by opening up alternative forms of listening, reading, voicing that are no longer historically available to us. So in place of the synchronic, concerned with the internal coherence of a particular set of discourses, we get something like the diachronic. So instead of the synchronic, which would look at a particular set of discourses or, say, the nexus of production, circulation, consumption of texts, we would see a diachronic approach to history concerned with continuities across periods, but also the currents of thought in which periodization takes place, not simply at the time of their foundation, but also retroactively. And so I'd see, say, Jonathan Culler's, I don't know if you looked at this, Jonathan Culler's article, Lyric, History, and Genre, as an exemplary version, and I use the word exemplary advisedly, of this treatment of history, though it also speaks to Boris Maslov's account of the persistence of forms. So what Culler is arguing, basically, is that there might not be a transhistorical concept of lyric, but nevertheless there are some kind of family resemblances that allow us to see Sappho as recognisably lyric and Shelley as recognisably lyric, and say some post-language poetry sort of returning to self-expression as recognisably lyric. Obviously, what Sappho thinks of as lyric, what the lyrical ballads think of as lyric, and what a contemporary lyric poet thinks of as lyric are very different things, but that historical change isn't to say that there isn't something recognisable that survives, simply that it needs to be understood through a kind of a history and, for colour, through a tradition. But in the case of reading Lanier in order to scan poems today, a diachronic approach would not simply place Lanier as part of our prehistory, but also us as part of Lanier's history. And one could perhaps even say sees Lanier's speculations as potentially part of our future. So I'm not suggesting that the Rutgers-Penn versus Cambridge-Cornell-Chicago division should be seen simply along synchronic versus diachronic lines, however. When Simon Jarvis argues that what is most historical is technique, insofar as technique is most confronted with obsolescence, that technique is the first thing to go out of date as times move on, he's being, as it were, both synchronic insofar as he wants to grasp these techniques from within a kind of phenomenological reconstruction of their contemporary moment. And so the difference between Simon and Yopi, I think, is partly where he sees those, what he sees the historical materials to be. So he's going to look at, say, reviews and stuff in order to see the adjectives that are being described, that being used to describe poems, so that he can ask, what did it feel like? And so it is a very much kind of like a phenomenological understanding of history. But so on the one hand, it's synchronic insofar as it's trying to reconstruct that at a particular historical moment, but it's diachronic insofar as it seeks to attune our ears so that we can attend to these effects once more, which isn't just going to affect scholarship, but would also affect the production of poetry today. Even if Prinz and Jarvis present their thinking in perpetual antagonism with one another, here there actually lies a fundamental similarity. The motivation behind historicization is that, in Prinz's phrase, we need to rethink our present assumptions about reading. I think that's something to which Simon Jarvis would definitely subscribe. The difference seems to be one of focus. Do we need to rethink our present assumptions about reading because of a tendency towards ideologically assuming our intentions to be universally binding, or because by rethinking our assumptions, we will become attuned to different forms of experience? One, if you like, sees the work of historical poetics as regulative. The other sees it as speculative. But it's also an argument around what kind of historical object a poem might be, or otherwise put, the question of the relative autonomy of the aesthetic. So Boris Maslov has argued that literary form is, and I quote, not just a product of history, but a unique kind of historical evidence that attests to the history of consciousness as well as to various socio-historical processes. And so there seem to be two different histories coinciding here, one of which is a kind of a longue durée, if you like, of the history of consciousness, and the other of which is a much more precise, kind of circumscribed understanding of history as socio-historical process. And at this point, I'd like to introduce one further and, again, slightly excessively schematic distinction, which is between reading the historical making of poiesis, poiesis being the Greek for making, but from which we also get our word poetry. So reading it either in terms of praxis, where it's bound up in the production of genre through the circulation and reception of texts, and where, again, to quote Prinz, genre is a mode of recognition instantiated in discourse, or whether we see poiesis in terms of techne, the historically specific making of verse, and the forms of knowing required for such making and generated by this making, which would be the sort of the Simon Jarvis approach. Again, I'm not saying that people only do one or the other, and that, in fact, the work that, to my mind, most satisfyingly does justice to both sets of exigencies is that of Ben Etherington, which makes it particularly... well, I'm not just sucking up to the organisers in saying this, but which makes it such a pleasure to be here thinking about this now. But I'm actually going to hazard the far greater claim, sort of holding close to the idea of poiesis as making, and eventually suggest that what poiesis makes is not particular genres or well-crafted poems, but in a fundamental and important way is history itself. So what do I mean by this? Well, the concept of living historically is itself historically relatively new. It dates back to the 18th century. And such a sense of being historical then has a phenomenological reality which will shape not just historical self-understanding, but historical agency. So basically, when we think of ourselves as historical agents, then we act differently and we make history differently. And that there is a particular moment in which that consciousness starts to pervades at least Western Europe and then further on. And so in what does this phenomenological reality consist? One way of seeing this would be that historical self-consciousness comes from an excess over the everyday, a transformed relation to the past, but also a transformed understanding of how one affects and affects the future. This is the sense that Lauren Ballant takes it when she traces a disturbed time in which a historical present distinguishes itself from everydayness. Because, and I quote, the atmosphere suggests a shift of historic proportions in the terms and processes of the conditions of continuity of life. And so, for Berlant, there are moments in which we basically live in everydayness, and then there are sudden moments where history seems to come alive and we recognize ourselves as historical, and that this is, for her, experienced as a kind of temporal disjunction where the conditions and processes of contemporary life suddenly start to change. And so suddenly history or being historical discloses itself differently. So if poems make history, this does not simply mean that they can be seen as historical agents themselves, which might from time to time affect somebody to act slightly differently, but also that poems themselves bear witness to the historical self-consciousness and contribute to the formation of such self-consciousness, that they chart and affect the shift from the everyday into the historical. Maslow suggests that literature's semi-autonomy arises from its being the discourse most absorptive of other kinds of discourse. At once, this makes it particularly effective as historical material because it's bringing all of these historical discourses together, but at the same time makes it distinctive from other kinds of material and so irreducible to historical scholarship. In this sense, historical poetics cannot remain merely a historicist account of poetry making, circulation, and consumption, but must take seriously the historical work that poems continually enact, the ways in which they record those moments at which, and this is what the phrase that Maslow uses, he's quoting Viktor Shklovsky, those moments at which social reality is caught in the act of becoming history. It's interesting that Shklovsky says social reality, Ballant says everydayness, but they seem to be working with the same kind of binary logic between a non-historical kind of day-to-day living and moments of recognizing one's historicity, and which are seen as moments, I guess, of rupture or moments at which the kind of intelligibility of day-to-day life no longer quite holds. So what I wish to propose is focusing on this word poiesis, a historical poietics, which attends to the moments in which poems attempt to register not just their own historical predicament, but something of historicity as such. Attempt, that is, to grasp those excesses by which the everyday ceases to be a sufficient framework through which to make sense of the temporal dynamics of lived experience. It is a poietics insofar as these poems are not simply attending to this shift, but they are also in some way enacting this shift. And they're demanding, if we are to think them, that we enact this shift in our turn. So reading them historically necessarily involves reading ourselves historically. And so my title, which has changed from the thing, The Register of History, is in this case a double genitive. It is at once the register proper to history itself, the diction and aspirations that poetry as historical intervention or historical thinking necessitates, and also the act of registering history, a means of making sense of living historically, the peculiarities of historical time. To repose my question then, how might poems make sense of those points at which the fabric of the everyday breaks down and something like historical time starts to emerge? But not just how they make sense of them, how might poems contribute to this process, integrate it into their making? And now I turn to my example. In April 1937, after his brief journey to Spain to work as an ambulance driver for the Republican cause in the Spanish Civil War, W. H. Auden wrote the poem Spain, published in a single pamphlet, the royalties of which were to go to medical aid for Spain. Spain would subsequently be retitled Spain 1937 in the 1940 collection Another Time, and eventually withdrawn from his body of work altogether, dismissed by its author as trash. As the poem is reworked and then discarded, we see a transformation in how Auden understands the historical work of poetry, something that today is impossible to read other than teleologically, given his infamous assertion in memory of W.B. Yeats, that poetry makes nothing happen. I'll come back to that phrase, but specifically in a much longer version that he gives of that in The People versus the late Mr. William Butler Yeats, which he's writing at the same time. The title change from Spain to Spain 1937 is already indicative of this shift, as the poem is retrospectively turned into a document of a particular moment, thus dissolving its previous categorical aspiration not to transcend history but to exceed it. But other stanzas were excised and several words changed. And so in front of you, I was hoping to have both versions, the 1940 version and the 1937 version. As it happens, I've only got the 1937 version. I should also say that when I typed this out, it was on Monday and I just got in from the airport, and so I was quite seriously jet-lagged. So there might be some typos, which is going to be a great embarrassment because I'm going to be talking about very small typographic changes. I assure you that those changes will be there. So unprofessional, sorry. So here is my example, or my exemplar, and how to think exactly about its exemplarity. I'm going to leave implicit just in order to be able to go through it, but it might be one of the questions that we want to raise in the questions. So the poem starts with a series of tableaux, each framed by the word yesterday, and the overall structure you can see moves from yesterday to today, and eventually tomorrow, perhaps, the future. What Auden is interested in throughout is how historical agency is formed and formulated. The early stanzas treat yesterday as a tenseless present, whose different aspects can be enumerated. The fact that this enumeration inhabits a language suspended between the literal and the concrete, and the figurative on the one hand and the figurative symbolic on the other, serves, I would suggest, to place it outside of historical time, but within a temporality of, if you like, a non-progressive recursion. This might also help clarify what I mean by the everyday. I don't mean the banal, but rather a form of temporality, or better, a form of non-temporalization. And it might also explain why a poem should be the medium through which to obtain this register of history, that there's something in its condensation of language into a peculiar temporal experience, something that Jonathan Culler has placed at the centre of his theory of the lyric. And I also recognise that prose often does also condense time in lots of ways, of course. So as Auden says, yesterday, all the past. There is a collapse of time into tenseless continuation, less the succession of individual elements than their equivalents. The enumeration through semicolons is indicative of this. Unlike either the colon or the comma, the semicolon does not imply subordination, be it causal, temporal, or ideational. It serves as the punctuation marker, almost of kind of parataxis over syntax. And in this, it seems peculiarly apposite for the nominalization of verbs, where agency and causation seem to have been excised from language. Note the indeterminacy of the invention of cartwheels and clocks, the taming of horses, where the primary genitive may be the clocks are invented, the horses are tamed, but there is the implicit presence of its inversion, clocks invent, horses tame. The grammar leaves open the possibility, and this is registered not just as syntactic, but also as temporal suspension. It is striking in this context that the first indicative verb belongs to the poet, who whispers. And that this might be, and I'm not going to push this, but it might be a kind of tentative figuring of a historical vocation of poetry. But then a bit later, when the poor call out, "O show us history, the operator, the organizer, time the refreshing river," this is partly a response to the crisis within the poem itself, a crisis born out of the suspension of cause, the suspension of organization. And this becomes a desire for history with a capital H. And what matters not is not how history shows itself. And so when he's asked to descend, it says it could be dove, furious pupper, mild engineer. What matters is that it show itself at all, that the everyday actually become historical, less through an act of conscious willing than through a quasi-mystical descent. And then in the response that the life gives, the life apparently standing in for history at this point, is that this descent will really be nothing more than a continuation of human behavior. The life says, I am whatever you do. But it's worth noticing that where before there were semicolons, and in Auden's 1940 revision there are once again semicolons, in the 37 version, this speech was arranged by colons. So the speech that the life gives is organized by a series of colons rather than semicolons. And this means it's not simply mere succession, but actually subordination, some form of syntactic organization. At a grammatical level, it appears that history is, in the earlier version, indeed an organizer. Only when we are living historically does temporality attain its coherence. As Auden revises the poem, he seems to retract the possibility of such a distinct form of organization. He returns these to semicolons, or at least wants to underplay the distinctiveness between the register through which the life speaks and that of the everydayness of the past. And this brings me to what I think is the crucial change made in the punctuation in the second version, and however innocuous it might first appear. So in stanza four, at the culmination of the descriptions of yesterday, we read, "The trial of heretics among the columns of stone. Yesterday, the theological feuds in the tavern and the miraculous cure at the fountain. Yesterday, the Sabbath of witches, but today the struggle." In the shift from in 1940, "but today the struggle," before that is not a semicolon, but a full stop. And in the shift from semicolon to period lies a radically different thematization of the ruptures and continuities of history, the way that the epochally transformative lies imminent within the everyday. The period, the full stop, signals the ordered break between the everydayness of yesterday, itself given as a list of semicolons, and the movement into history. If the qualitative shift between this everydayness and a moment in which our history is up for grabs, the moment at which the dominant part of speech shifts from noun to verb, takes place within the very grammar of the everyday, i.e. if it continues to use the semicolon, then it turns out that within the everyday continually inheres the possibility of ruptures and breaks, ruptures that might at first appear indiscernible from the texture of everyday life, but which then can fissure into epochal change. The change then is not simply the stabilization of the grammar with the prosodic effect of elongating the caesura a little. I mean, there's stuff to be said about the intonational structure, I think, of this stanza in particular, as it kind of it moves from different intonational units that kind of get smaller as the stanza progresses. But we see something like a stabilization of historical periods through the reintroduction of grammatical order in place of porousness. So my argument is that in the first version, the semicolon figures a kind of porousness between the everyday and the historical, whereas in the second version, by placing a full stop, there is actually a far more ordered break. And it's really interesting in this sense that in both versions, "but today the struggle" in this, it arrives three times sort of in three consecutive stanzas. In the other two, it's a full stop before "but today the struggle." Here it's a semicolon. And so the implication is that after the first moment in which "but today the struggle" emerges from the everyday, it becomes increasingly separated. The poem is thus registering a process through which the break emerges from out of the texture of the everyday, rather than taking these temporal modes to be a priori distinct. So we've got these two revisions, one of which takes out a semicolon, the other of which replaces colons with semicolons, and they seem to pull in opposite directions. On the one hand, the later version is now intimating that the transition from the everyday to historical time is an absolute break, rather than a porousness within the temporality of everydayness, an aporetic opening up within the fabric of the everyday by its own grammar. On the other, it is now suggesting that historical time does not introduce syntactic ordering or organization into the detemporalized succession of everydayness. He is both insisting on the radical exteriority of history and on its indistinctiveness and on the idea that nothing really will change. But this is hardly the same as what came before, where there was a radical imminence of history within the everyday, and the possibility of genuine rupture. In fact, it seems that both changes serve as an attempt to inoculate oneself against historical being. And in fact, I'd say we can see this tendency throughout the revisions. So take, for example, two stanzas excised from the 1940 version. I'll just point to where those stanzas are, sorry. So this is the bottom of the second page of the handout, the sort of the last three stanzas on the second page of the handout, where he says, "Our thoughts have bodies. The menacing shapes of our fever are precise and alive. For the fears which made us respond to the medicine ad and the brochure of winter cruises have become invading battalions. And our faces, the institute face, the chain store, the ruin, are projecting their greed as the firing squad and the bomb. Madrid is the heart. Our moments of tenderness blossom as the ambulance and the sandbag. Our hours of friendship into a people's army." Again, Auden is tracing the transformation of basic consumerist behaviour and a life that seems fundamentally inauthentic, our faces, the institute face, the chain store, into a sudden blossoming, be it through a sudden epiphanic rupture through which charitable works suddenly shift from escapism into the impetus of revolutionary action. And it's worth recalling that this poem kind of is a medical ad, insofar as all of the proceeds from the pamphlet are then being sent to medical aid for Spain. So either we get a sudden epiphanic rupture, or alternatively, through the transformation of friendship and tenderness into a people's army. And one of the important things, I guess, here is that in the three words of the French Republic, liberté, égalité, fraternité, fraternité is the one that kind of fell out of liberal discourse. We still care about equality and liberty, but it was fraternité, or brotherhood, or fraternity, which was then taken up by communists, firstly in the Paris Commune, and then subsequently. The shift does not become the simple appropriation. But okay, so you've got these two different ways in which it's figuring this transformation, but that isn't to say that we suddenly therefore become agents, as though we overcome inauthenticity and enter action. Agency throughout these stanzas is continually decentered, whether in our thoughts have bodies, or the fears have become battalions, our faces are projecting their greed. Agency is something given by the grammar. And here too, as throughout the poem, the word as becomes a crucial figure of this jointure or suspension. And as in lots of these examples and throughout the poem, it's never entirely clear whether it's being used as a temporal adverb or whether it's being used as a conjunction, a kind of as though of a simile. The first indicative verb, as I said, features the poet. It's as the poet whispers, startled among the pines. And here it's particularly unclear whether as is temporal or whether it's conjunctive, which prevents any clear entry into causal sequence, precisely at the moment at which today the struggle would seem to be leading into a kind of causation. Similarly, in their greed as the firing squad and the bomb, and then our moments of tenderness blossom as the ambulance and the sandbag, as would describe a moment of transformation, an opening up of history with a capital H, as a horizon within which we act. But within the poem's general economy, where as is suspended between conjunction and adverb, metamorphosis is temporalized, not just the temporality of causal succession, but if you like, a temporalization within language itself, the kind of the enactment by language of opening up a temporal horizon. The final line then is the first in the current register without main verb. Much of the scandal which led to Auden's revisions concerned the phrase necessary murder. This is a few stanzas further down. It's the third last stanza, second line, which George Orwell found indicative of, I quote, an utterly irresponsible intelligentsia. Auden's first response to this was to provide a defence justified in the rather unconvincing syllogism, one, to kill another human being is always murder, two, in a war, the two sides murder their opponents, they kill their opponents, three, if a war can be said to be just, then murder is in some cases necessary. But the later version retreats from this defence, replacing the offending phrase necessary murder with the fact of murder, which also kind of changes the accentual pattern quite a bit. But what the line opens up, this phrase, necessary murder, is precisely the instability between murder and justified killing. The incarnation of the poem as its most positivistic, saying these are necessary, is also the one in which these positivistic distinctions are made untenable. And in this sense, the earlier formulation is representative of the historical predicament that Spain continually registers. On the one hand, the desire for a transformation into an authentic historical agency. On the other, the destabilization of such distinctions as the everyday versus the historical. This porousness goes in both directions. Everydayness can suddenly open into the historical so that social reality necessitates a reframing of the real. But at the same time, one can never be truly historical. If history lies in the ruptures, aporia, excesses over a particular economy of the real or of the everyday, then this history too is ruptured. Strictly speaking, we are never really historical, but our never really being historical is itself experienced as a historical predicament. So after this poem, Auden, and in its retraction, we get a history which is kind of told a lot about sort of the political poetry of the 1930s and of Auden in particular, where we see through its revisions, then its banishment altogether, a fundamental shift in Auden's own belief of what poetry can do and what it cannot, the historical work that poetry may or may not be able to enact. It is not precisely a linear development, but I'll sketch out some landmarks quickly. So it starts in 1931 with Auden living in Berlin, witnessing the murdering of communists by the German army in 1931. Then continues with 1933's The Dance of Death, a response to the rise of Hitler, which both suggests that Marx might be the answer, whilst at the same time burlesquing Marx himself within the play and its final tableau. And then this period of political engagement culminates with his leaving for Spain. At this point, he still evinces scepticism about the activist role for poetry. In a letter he writes just before leaving, he says, and I quote, "I am not one of those who believe that poetry need or even should be directly political. But in a critical period such as ours, I do believe that the poet must have direct knowledge of the major political events. Though direct knowledge here implies one must be participant as well as observer." And when Yopi writes, what kinds of knowing, it seems that for Auden, it's not just knowing as acquaintance, but it's knowing as engagement that he has in mind. Then in October 1938, in a review, he will celebrate André Malraux's novel, Days of Hope, by saying, and I quote, "Inefficiencies, cruelties, intrigues, the conflict between..." Days of Hope is a novel about the Spanish Republican cause. "Inefficiencies, cruelties, intrigues, the conflict between anarchists and communists, between those who want to be something and those who want to do something, are not glossed over. But through all the mess and muddle, the amazing courage and determination of the Spanish people shines out very clearly. So that if you choose to call it so, Days of Hope is propaganda. Propaganda for the truth." And it seems as though there he is really thinking about Spain, which again wants to show all of the muddle, but nevertheless seems to have some kind of propaganda role. And yet 3 months after the review of Malraux, he will write in The Public versus the late Mr. William Butler Yeats, through the mouthpiece of his defence counsel, a much more elaborate version of the claim that I quoted before, that poetry makes nothing happen. This is the last quote on the handout. It says, "For art is a product of history, not a cause. Unlike some other products, technical inventions, for example, it does not re-enter history as an effective agent, so that the question whether art should or should not be propaganda is unreal. The case for the prosecution rests on the fallacious belief that art ever makes anything happen, whereas the honest truth, gentlemen, is that if not a poem had been written, not a picture painted, not a bar of music composed, the history of man would be materially unchanged." And then continues, "But there is one field in which the poet is a man of action, the field of language, and it is precisely in this that the greatness of the deceased is most obviously shown. However false or undemocratic his ideas, his diction shows a continuous evolution towards what one might call the true democratic style. The social virtues of a real democracy are brotherhood and intelligence, and the parallel linguistic virtues are strength and clarity." Although here it's also interesting that whilst he is saying the poetry cannot be propaganda, the justification is nevertheless linked to social justice. Yes, he might not be democratic in his politics, but he is democratic in his art. So Auden hasn't entirely given up on a politics of poetry. It's just that it's been displaced onto language. And this you can map back onto In Memory of W.B. Yeats, where poetry makes nothing happen, but it survives. And then, what's it, in the valley of it saying where executives would never cease to tamper, and then it survives a way of happening, a mouth. There's the same kind of recuperative moment going on that, in a way, what's interesting about Auden at this period isn't the statements themselves, but rather the contradictions and the way those contradictions are kind of continually being worked through in sort of slightly different incarnations. So the final act of the story comes with 1 September 1939, the other dated poem of the 30s, which envisages the historicising vocation of poetry through its bearing witness to a historical moment. The 1st of September 1939 was the date of Hitler's invasion of Poland. And this is most striking in its branding of the 30s, you recall, as a low, dishonest decade. So here, poetry would not make history as a historical participant, but specifically as a witness, a documenter, searching out a register for history. Its historical making is now retroactive, although again the matrix of potential future actions is itself reconfigured by our reframed narratives of the past. And so you might see him to be doing something similar with the Age of Anxiety in the 50s, where the Age of Anxiety is again a historical naming, not as an intervention, but rather as a kind of way of defining an epoch. So what is most striking here, and don't worry, this is my final paragraph, what is most striking here is that when Auden becomes historian, the instabilities of the historical that have pervaded Spain have been diffused. He can be an observer because he stands outside of this historical moment in a dive bar on 52nd Street, as he says. Historicization here has become a means of inoculating oneself from history. And it is at this juncture that the question of how poetics is historical becomes the basis for reflection on historical poetics. By making history an object, we are absolving ourselves of the responsibility of being historical ourselves. By reading Auden's poem back into its discourses, it becomes a more easily masterable object, and we are inoculated from its far more speculative and therefore embarrassing historical thinking, the excesses and ruptures within it which open up not a transhistorical frame, but rather those fissures out of which the making of history might arise. Precisely that from which Auden himself recoils, but precisely that to which we need as readers and historical beings to hold fidelity. The alternative to historicism, whether one thinks of it as a largely synchronic account of discourses and genres, or by sketching a longue durée of the persistence of forms, is not the naive assertion of transhistorical values, but rather a reminder of the peculiar dynamics of history, its condensations, its distensions, its caesurae. For historicization is itself a response to a historical predicament. We historicize others so as not to confront history ourselves. We find a register of history in order to avoid actually registering it. And I find myself, sort of parenthetically, doing this a lot today on a day-to-day basis with the rise of an authoritarian nativist conservatism in my own country. By historicizing it, it feels both more momentous, and therefore I can't do anything, but also somehow intellectually and thereby emotionally more manageable. I can at least theorize it. But what Auden's Spain does is find a different kind of register for history. By internalizing a series of contradictions integral to being historical, whether as regards a desire to trace the shift from an agencyless everydayness into an authentic historical being, or to articulate a vocation for poetry which can affect this shift, whilst at the same time unravelling these distinctions and envisaging history as an impersonal power which denies its agency. So that's a very long sentence. I'm going to do this one again. That Auden Spain finds a register of history precisely in the levels of contradiction going on and the different kinds of historical experiencing and historical desiring you get. So on the one hand, there is, it articulates this desire to trace a shift from the everyday into the historical. It also traces a desire for poetry to be at some level architect of that shift, whilst at the same time it unravels the very distinction between historical and everyday, and treats history either as an impersonal power with a capital H, or alternatively just as the culmination of all human action. So it's either impersonal or it is us. That by having all of these things placed together in a barely understood set of contradictions, it seems to register the ways, it register history by exhibiting the ways in which we are never historical. So it might not exemplify historical poetics as a theorization of poetry within history, but becomes exemplary in its confrontation with and internalization of so many of these historical contradictions. And historical contradictions just not as in the contradictions of its historical moment, but rather the contradictions of thinking history and internalizing these into the fabric of its poiesis. Thank you.